This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, this is Irene Friedman, and the program is All About Animals. Coming up on today's program, we'll start off with some facts about musical animals from the National Geographic book, 5,000 Awesome Facts About Animals. And after those facts, I'll read a chapter in a street cat named Bob and How He Saved My Life by James Bowen. And then I have something from Family Dog Magazine, and we'll see how far that gets us. So here are our facts about musical animals. One study found that cows make more milk when they listen to slow songs. Grasshoppers that live near busy roads sing louder. Mockingbird males can sing for 24 hours a day during the breeding season. The male kakapo bird digs a shallow bowl in the ground, bowls in parentheses, then stands inside and sings. The bowl amplifies its song. Songbirds have accents that make their song sound slightly different depending on where they live. Nightingales know up to 300 love songs. Bats flying in a group take turns singing their echolocation songs so they can listen to each other. Elephants can learn to play the harmonica. And finally, the study of animal music is called zoo musicology. And those are our facts for today. Chapter 17 in our book, A Street Cat Named Bob, Chapter 17, is entitled 48 Hours. The young doctor at the DDU, the Drug Dependency Unit, scribbled his signature at the bottom of the prescription and handed it over to me with a stern expression on his face. Remember, take this, then come back to me at least 48 hours later when you can feel the withdrawal symptoms have really kicked in, he said, holding my gaze. It's going to be tough, but it will be a lot tougher if you don't stick to what I've said, okay? Okay, I understand, I nodded, picking myself up and heading out of his treatment room. Just hope I can do it. See you in a couple of days. I've been turning up at my fortnightly consultations for a couple of months since we had first talked about coming off methadone. I thought I was ready for it, but my counselors and doctors obviously didn't share that opinion. Each time I'd come in, they had kept postponing it. I had not got any kind of explanation as to why this was. Now, Lacey decided it was time. I was going to make the final step towards being clean. The prescription the counselor had just given me was for my last dose of methadone. Methadone had helped me kick my dependence on heroin, but I'd now tapered down my usage to such an extent that it was time to stop taking it for good. When I came next to the DDU in a couple of days' time, I would be given my first dose of a much milder medication, Subutex, which would ease me out of drug dependency completely. The counselor described the process as like landing an airplane, which I thought was a good analogy. In the following months, he would slowly cut back my dosage until it was almost non-existent. As he did so, he said I would slowly drop back down to earth, landing hopefully with a very gentle bump. As I waited for the prescription to be made up today, I didn't really dwell on the significance of it. My head was too busy with thoughts about what lay ahead during the next 48 hours. The counselor had explained the risks to me in graphic detail. Coming off methadone wasn't easy. In fact, it was really hard. I had experienced clucking or cold turkey, a series of unpleasant physical and mental withdrawal symptoms. I had to wait for those symptoms to become quite severe before I could go back to the clinic to get my first dose of Subutex. If I didn't, I'd risk having what's known as a precipitated withdrawal. This was basically a much worse withdrawal. It didn't bear thinking about. I was confident at this point that I could do it. But at the same time, I had an awful niggling feeling that I could fail and find myself wanting to score something that would make me feel better. But I just kept telling myself that I had to do this. I had to get over this last hurdle. Otherwise, it was going to be the same the next day and the next day and the day after that. Nothing was going to change. This was the reality that had finally dawned on me. I had been living this way for 10 years. A lot of my life had just slipped away. I had wasted so much time sitting around watching the days vanish. When you are dependent on drugs, minutes become hours, hours become days. It all just slips by. Time becomes inconsequential. You only start worrying about it when you need your next fix. You don't even care until then. But that's when it becomes so awful. Then all you can think about is making money to get some more. I've made huge progress since I'd been in the depths of my heroin addiction years earlier. The DDU had really put me back on track. But I was just sick of the whole thing now, having to go to a chemist every day, having to visit the DDU every fortnight, having to prove that I hadn't been using. I had had enough. I now felt like I had something to do with my life. In a way, I had made it harder on myself by insisting on doing it alone. I had been offered the chance several times to join Narcotics Anonymous, but I just didn't like the whole 12-step program. I couldn't do that kind of quasi-religious thing. It's almost like you have to give yourself up to a higher power. It just wasn't me. I realized that I was making life even more difficult for myself by taking that route. The difference was I didn't think I was on my own. Now, I had Bob. As usual, I didn't take him with me to the DDU clinic. I didn't like exposing him to the place. It was a part of my life I wasn't proud about, even though I did feel I had achieved a lot since I had first visited. When I got home, he was pleased to see me, especially as I had stopped off at the supermarket on the way home and had a bag full of goodies intended to get us through the next 2 days. Anyone who is trying to get rid of an addictive habit knows what it is like, whether it's trying to give up cigarettes or alcohol. The first 48 hours are the hardest. You're so used to getting your fix that you can't think of anything else. The trick is to think of something else, obviously, and that's what I hope to do. I was just really grateful that I had Bob to help me achieve it. That lunchtime, we sat down in front of the television, had a snack together, and waited. The methadone generally lasted for around 20 hours, so the first part of the day passed easily enough. Bob and I played around a lot and went out for a short walk so that he could do his business. I played a really old version of the original Halo 2 game on my knackered old Xbox. At that point, it all seemed to be plain sailing. I knew it couldn't stay that way for much longer. Probably the most famous recreation of someone clucking is in the film Trainspotting, in which Ian McGregor's character, Renton, decides to rid himself of his heroin addiction. He is locked in a room with a few days of food and drink and left to get on with it. He goes through the most horrendous physical and mental experience you can imagine, getting the shakes, having hallucinations, being sick, all that stuff. Everyone remembers the bit where he imagines he is climbing inside the toilet bowl. What I went through over the next 48 hours felt 10 times worse than that. The withdrawal symptoms began to kick in just after 24 hours after I had had my dose of methadone. Within 8 hours of that, I was sweating profusely and feeling very twitchy. By now it was the middle of the night and I should have been asleep. I did nod off, but I felt like I was pretty much conscious all the time. It was a strange kind of sleep, full of dreams or, more accurately, hallucinations. It's hard to recollect exactly, but I do remember having these lucid dreams about scoring heroin. There were a lot of these dreams, and they always went the same way. I would either score and spill it, score and not be able to get a needle into my vein, or score but then get arrested by the police before I could use it. It was weird. It was obviously my body's way of registering the fact that it was being denied this substance that it had once been used to being fed every 12 hours or so. But it was also my subconscious trying to persuade me that maybe it was a good idea to start using it again. Deep in my brain, there was obviously this huge battle of wills going on. It was almost as if I was a bystander watching it all happen to someone else. It was strange. Coming off heroin years ago wasn't as bad. The transition to methadone had been reasonably straightforward. This was a different experience altogether. Time ceased to have any real meaning, but by the following morning, I was beginning to experience really bad headaches, almost migraine-level pains. As a result, I found it hard to cope with any light or noise. I'd try and sit in the dark, but then I'd start dreaming or hallucinating, and want to snap myself out of it. It was a vicious circle. What I needed more than anything was something to take my mind off at all, which was where Bob proved my salvation. There were times when I wondered whether Bob and I had some kind of telepathic understanding. He could definitely read my mind sometimes and seemed to be doing so now. He knew that I needed him, so he was a constant presence, hanging around me, snuggling up close when I invited him, but keeping his distance when I was having a bad time. It was as if he knew what I was feeling. Sometimes I'd be nodding off, and he would come up to me and place his face close to me as if to say, "You all right, mate? I'm here if you need me." At other times, he would just sit with me, purring away, rubbing his tail on me, and licking my face every now and then. As I slipped in and out of a weird hallucinatory universe, he was my sheet anchor to reality. He was a godsend in other ways, too. For a start, he gave me something to do. I still had to feed him, which I did regularly. The process of going into the kitchen, opening up a sachet of food, and mixing it in the bowl was just the sort of thing I needed to get my mind off what I was going through. I didn't feel up to going downstairs to help him do his business, but when I let him out, he dashed off and was back upstairs again in what seemed like a few minutes. He didn't seem to want to leave my side. I've had periods where I didn't feel so bad. During the morning of the second day, for instance, I had a couple of hours where I felt much better. Bob and I just played around a bit. I did a bit of reading. It was hard, but it was a way to keep my mind occupied. I read a really good nonfiction book about a Marine saving dogs in Afghanistan. It was good to think about what was going on in someone else's life. By the afternoon and early evening of the second day, however, the withdrawal symptoms were really ramping up. The worst thing was the physical stuff. I've been warned that when you go through clucking, you get what's called restless leg syndrome. In effect, you have incredibly uncomfortable, nervous pulses that run through your body, making it impossible for you to sit still. I started doing this. My legs would suddenly and involuntarily start kicking. It's not called kicking the habit for nothing. I think this freaked Bob out a bit. He gave me a couple of odd sideways looks, but he didn't desert me. He stayed there at my side. That night was the worst of all. I couldn't watch television because the light and noise hurt my head. When I went into the dark, I just found my mind racing, filling up with all kinds of crazy, scary stuff. All the time, my legs were kicking and I was feeling extremes of hot and cold. One minute I was so hot, I felt like I was inside a furnace. The next, I'd feel ice cold. The sweat that had built up all over me would suddenly start to freeze, and suddenly I'd be shivering. So then I'd have to cover up and would start burning up again. It was a horrible cycle. Every now and then, I'd have moments of lucidity and clarity. At one point, I remember thinking that I really understood why so many people find it so hard to kick their drug habits. It's a physical thing as well as a mental thing. That battle of wills that's going on in your brain is very one-sided. The addictive forces are definitely stronger than those that are trying to wean you off the drugs. At another point, I was able to see the last decade of what my addiction had done to me. I saw and sometimes smelled the alleys and underpasses where I'd slept rough, the hostels where I'd feared for my life, the terrible things I'd done and considered doing just to score enough to get me through the next 12 hours. I saw with unbelievable clarity just how seriously addiction screws up your life. I had some weird, almost surreal thoughts as well. For instance, at one point it occurred to me that if I was to wake up with amnesia, I'd get through the withdrawal because I wouldn't know what was wrong with me. A lot of my problems stem from the fact my body knew exactly what was wrong with me and what I could do to fix it. I won't deny that there were moments of weakness when it crossed my mind when I imagined scoring. But I was able to fend those thoughts off pretty easily. This was my chance to kick it, maybe my last chance. I had to stay strong. I had to take it. The diarrhea, the cramps, the vomiting, the headaches, the wildly fluctuating temperatures, all of it. That second night seemed to last forever. I'd look up at the clock, and it seemed at times as if it was moving backwards. Outside, it seemed as if the darkness was getting deeper and blacker rather than brightening up for morning. It was horrible. But I had my secret weapon. Bob did annoy me at certain points. At one stage, I was lying as still and quiet as possible, just trying to shut out the world. All of a sudden, I felt Bob clawing at my leg, digging into my skin quite painfully. "Bob, what the hell are you doing?" I shouted at him a bit too aggressively, making him jump immediately. I felt guilty. I suspect he was worried that I was a little too still and quiet and was checking up to make sure I was still alive. He was worried about me. Eventually, a thin, soupy gray light began to seep through the window, signaling that morning had arrived at last. I hauled myself out of bed and looked at the clock. It was almost 8 o'clock. I knew the clinic would be open by 9. I couldn't wait any longer. I splashed some cold water on my face. It felt absolutely awful on my clammy skin. In the mirror, I could see that I looked drawn, and my hair was a sweaty mess. But I wasn't going to worry about that at this point. Instead, I threw on some clothes and headed straight for the bus stop. Getting to Camden from Tottenham at that time of the day was always a trial. Today it seemed much worse. Every traffic light was on red. Every road seemed to have a long tail back of traffic. It really was the journey from hell. As I sat on the bus, I was still having those huge temperature swings. Sweating one moment, shivering the next, my limbs were still twitching every now and again, although not as badly as during the middle of the night. People were looking at me as if I was some kind of nutcase. I probably looked unbelievably bad. At that point, I didn't care. I just wanted to get to the DDU. I arrived just after 9 and found the waiting room half full already. One or two people looked as rough as I felt. I wondered whether they'd been through 48 hours as hellish as those I'd just been through. "Hi, James. How are you feeling?" the counselor said as he came into the treatment room. He only needed to look at me to know the answer, of course, but I appreciated his concern. "Not great," I said. "Well, you've done well. Do get through the last 2 days. That's a huge step you've taken," he smiled. He checked me over and got me to give a urine sample. He then gave me a tablet of Subutex and scribbled out a new prescription. "That should make you feel a lot better," he said. "Now let's start easing you off this and out of this place completely." I stayed there for a while to make sure the new medication didn't have any odd side effects. It didn't. Quite the opposite, in fact. It made me feel 1,000 times better. By the time I got back to Tottenham, I felt completely transformed. It was a different feeling from what I had experienced on methadone. The world seemed more vivid. I felt like I could see, hear, and smell more clearly. Colors were brighter. Sounds were crisper. It was weird. It may sound strange, but I felt more alive again. I stopped on the way and bought Bob a couple of new flavored Sheba pouches that had come onto the market. I also bought him a little toy, a squeezy mouse. Back at the flat, I made a huge fuss of him. "We did it, mate," I said. "We did it." The sense of achievement was incredible. Over the next few days, the transformation in my health and life in general was huge. It was as if someone had drawn back the curtains and shed some sunlight into my life. Of course, in a way, someone had. And that's the end of this chapter. From Family Dog Magazine, a historical story. Westford Hound, with 40 horses, 40 servants, 40 guns, 40 dogs, and 40 of everything else, Lord Gore left some unusual legacies in America, including four-footed ones named Speed, Lady Possum, Fly, and Burster. The article is by Brian Patrick Duggan. 19th century America was no stranger to British pilgrims, including Charles Dickens, Rudyard Kipling, and Oscar Wilde. But perhaps the most extraordinary was Sir St. George Gore, who came to hunt the wilderness with his hounds, but in the highest style. An Oxford-educated baronet with 7,000 acres in Ireland, Gore was beyond wealthy. He devoted his life to sport, shooting, fishing, and running his Scottish deerhounds and greyhounds. Gore's greyhound, Shade, and Magician won the Waterloo Cup, respectively, in 1848 and 1849. With deerhounds, he stalked the Red Stag in the Scottish Highlands. Lord Saltoun observed, "He had a great number of deerhounds selected or bred with great care." Others had different opinions. Gore exhibited at early dog shows and in 1865 was criticized for a deerhound that was almost smooth, a big, coarse, ugly greyhound in appearance that, of course, did not take a prize. Another peer asserted his were very fine deerhounds. Good or not, he brought them to America. His dry land ark. In 1854, 43-year-old Gore disembarked with servants, animals, and a mountain of baggage. By rail and steamboat, he journeyed to St. Louis, the jumping-off point for emigrant wagon trains. Staying at the ritzy planter's house to organize his trek, Gore kenneled hounds and horses on a convenient island in the Missouri River. Reporter, disdainfully characterized his like as my Lord Fitz Snooks, and so many dogs and servants en route for the plains. No expense was spared for comfort. Unique was Gore's special wagon, with spring suspension that converted into a rainproof room with a crank. Living quarters were a 180-square-foot green and white striped tent furnished with rugs and take-apart furniture. There were barrels of whiskey, brandy, and gunpowder, a small library, crates of cigars, and 3 milk cows. His large staff included valet, cook, gunsmith, fishing lure maker, and horse grooms. Wisely, Gore hired the famous Jim Bridger as his guide, along with a small battalion of mountain men for bodyguards. The gear was loaded in 21 carts and 6 wagons. All were hauled by horses, mules, and oxen, with hounds trotting alongside. Between 40 and 50 dogs, mostly greyhounds and staghounds, one of the most beautiful breeds. Bridger led Gore's party beyond the isolated army forts, trapper stockades, homesteads, and river towns to lands abundant with big game. He hunted alone each day, returning at dusk with his trophies. There were constant hound chases after hoof game, coyote, and wolf. The baronet spent some $500,000, which would be many millions today, and traveled over 6,000 miles. On his way home in 1857, he was back in St. Louis with horses and his 40 hounds. But during that nearly 3-year journey, dogs died and dogs were born. Many of those pups were left at army posts. The dogs he left behind. At least one turned up in northeast New Mexico in 1858. In charge of Fort Union's arsenal, Captain William Raleigh Shoemaker lived with his family on post. Shoemaker had 10 greyhounds kenneled in the commissary's corral and cared for by Corporal Thompson, a keen houndman from Virginia. Possum, across from one of Gore's, was their leader. Tall and long, he was acclaimed for speed and strength. Possum in the pack, slightly assisted by Toots, a black setter, hunted regularly for jackrabbit, antelope, wolf, buffalo, and occasionally unwanted skunk. Captain Eugene F. Ware, 7th Iowa Cavalry, pen named Iron Quill, discovered the large number of splendid greyhounds at Fort Kearney, Nebraska in 1864. Built to protect emigrants on the Oregon and Mormon trails, Gore's party had camped there in 1854. Several greyhound pups became the fort's common property with ownership assigned by the commanding officer. Waite and Captain O'Brien were given Lady and Kearney, beautiful animals. Lady was jet black and the finest hunter, Bugler, a powerfully voiced scent hound, was purchased from a wagon train to join the hunts. His nose prevailed when antelope, jackrabbit, and wolf disappeared into cover. Then in parentheses, Bugler's replacement was a Virginia staghound named Bugler No. 2. Ware's pack increased with Fanny, Fly, and Nellie. A large white girl ranked as second fastest. Sadly, Nellie died after gobbling strychnine, laced wolf bait. Ware countermanded that practice and dryly wrote, after that, the poisoning of wolves was discontinued. In Dakota Territory, at Fort Sauley, the 22nd Infantry had their own sporting club. Captain Jabin Irvine was posted there in 1867, bringing along his greyhounds to combine with the post greyhounds, staghounds, and foxhounds. The commanding officer, General David S. Stanley, was elected Cub president and Irvine secretary treasurer. Their pack had offspring of Cup winners in England and Ireland, including the celebrated Waterloo Cup winner, Master McGrath. Irvine's foundation pair, Speed and Drew, were both from Gore's stock. Speed's sire was an imported rough-haired Scotch greyhound, and his dam, an English greyhound. Speed himself could catch buffalo and wolf. Had it not been for his badly healed broken foreleg, Speed might have been as swift as their best hounds, Harry Sweep and Mossy. Drew, a greyhound, wasn't the fastest, but had powerful endurance. Notable pups from Speed and Drew's, born August 1871, were Buster, Diamond, and Louisa. Speed sired 2 more litters that summer. Diamond was energetic, tough, and foolish, not as fast as nervous Diamond. Louisa had better sense. Buster stood 30 inches high, the largest dog in a pack of 60. In turn, Buster sired Leo out of Gypsy. Both Buster and Leo, another big boy at 75 pounds, could handily run down either antelope or jackrabbit. From June through September 1873, Stanley commanded elements of several regiments as escort for a railroad survey expedition into the Yellowstone country. The sporting club voted to send Gibbon, Sweep, Donovan, and George, along with their contingent. Newly arrived from reconstruction duty in the South, Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, 7th Cavalry, would accompany the column. George and Libby Custer had their own pack of deerhounds and greyhounds. Friendly rivalry between Stanley and Custer was immediate. A referred match took place, but despite Custer's braggadocio, his hounds didn't win. To be fair, they had just trekked 400 miles in 16 days, and the Sauley hounds were on home ground. After 12 years at Fort Sauley in 1879, the companies of the 22nd would be reassigned to posts across Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas. Now at Fort Griffin, 50 miles from Abilene, Irvine proudly recorded that his old girl Drew, at 12 years, was still catching jackrabbits. Gore's legacy. A loner all his life, Gore died childless in Scotland in 1878. Namesake places are a permanent reminder of him: the Gore Range, mountain, pass, hill, canyon, creek, and lake. And I do wonder about South Dakota's Greyhound Gulch and Montana's Whitehound Canyon. However, Gore's most obscure bequest is the distributed DNA from Possum, Lady, Kearney, Fanny, Fly, Nellie, Speed, Drew, Burster, Louisa, Diamond, Leo, and so on. And let's see, do I have time for the sidebar, I think. So, Army Greyhounds at Westminster. In 1878, at the 2nd Westminster Kennel Club bench show, in a class of 23 Greyhounds, General Stanley had two entries, Fleet from Fort Sauley and imported Penn Kawan, a Master McGrath's line. If Custer had not been killed in 1876 at Little Bighorn, he might well have competed in that ring with his own Greyhounds against his former commanding officer. To learn more about Gore's extraordinary expedition, see Baronets and Buffalo, The British Sportsman in the American West, 1833 to 1881 by John I. Merritt. For the Fort Sauley Sporting Club and the Custer's Hunting Hounds, see my own General Custer, Libby Custer, and their dogs, A Passion for Hounds from the Civil War to Little Bighorn. And Brian Patrick Duggan, who wrote this, is a canine historian and the award-winning author of the newly released Horror Dogs, Man's Best Friend, His Movie Monster. Well published on Dog Topics, Duggan's the editor for McFarland Publishers' Dogs in Our World series and the author of Saluki, the Desert Hound and the English Travelers Who Brought It to the West. And it looks like with that, I am now out of time. So, articles I had saved for today, I'll read them next week. This is Irene Friedman, thanking you for tuning in. As always, a reminder about spaying and neutering cats and dogs. Shelters are overflowing with kittens right now. So please spay and neuter. And to everyone out there, thank you for tuning in and listening. And everyone have a great day and a great week. Goodbye, everyone.